Well, greetings everybody, and I'm really excited about day five of creation, and all of those of you who are keen fishermen should be very thankful too. So let's open up our Bibles to Genesis chapter 1, please. And we're looking at chapter 1, verse 20. And just as we're getting there, I want to ask us a little bit of reasoning and to engage in some reasoning. So when you look at this picture here, this is, I believe, a legitimate question that comes to mind. When you look at this clownfish in this photo in its marine habitat, is it possible, is it likely that it was the result of billions of years of non-directed, unintelligent chance processes? Now, this clownfish is in what they call a symbiotic relationship with the anemone. And I've actually seen these live at the marine research station in Nuku'alofa in Tonga. And they're fascinating to see them swimming around in amongst the arms of the anemone, and they don't get stung. Now, the symbiotic relationship is quite interesting. First of all, the clownfish has developed, I believe God-given, the capacity to secrete a mucus, which it has to cover its entire body, which neutralizes the toxins in the anemone's arms. If a clownfish has a bit of an injury and a bit of that skin is exposed, they're in dire trouble. So it's an amazing protective coating, if you like. And it does my head in trying to believe how incrementally evolution could by chance develop an immunizing mucus that would neutralize the chemicals of the anemone, because obviously when it didn't work, the clownfish would die. And so how on earth you get this genetic information accidentally passed on is mind-staggering. The second thing is, in what way is the relationship between the clownfish and the anemone symbiotic? In other words, what mutual benefits do they give each other? Well, the clownfish, believe it or not, cleans algae and other bits of food debris and stuff off the anemone's tentacles, and so keeps it clean. Well, what does the anemone offer clownfish? Obviously, it's protection from predators, because if anything tries to get too close to it, it gets stung and it's in big trouble. But I found out that there's another benefit that the clownfish does for the anemone. There's another marine reef fish called the butterfly fish that actually loves to eat and has the capacity to eat these anemones and finds them very tasty. It might sound unusual to us that we would eat anemones, but there it is. There is a fish that loves this particular anemone. And when this butterfly fish comes to have a go at the anemone, guess what? The clownfish acts as a sentry and as a little soldier and beats off the attacking predator. Isn't that a fascinating relationship? Well, here's my question. I want you to look at this poster of the Nemo film. Now, there's the poster of the Nemo film. Now, if we examine this poster, do you believe that that poster could accidentally get there by chance? And I'll be generous if I gave you 10 billion years. And I'll even give you some pots of paint and some bits of paper and a few brushes, if you like. Anyone think yes? Okay, let's consider the science now, the empirical observable evidence in the poster. The poster has evidence of design. okay? And it has these principles of design evident before our eyes. There's the composition of the content. So you've got content, you've got fish, you've got seaweed, you've got water, and you've got signage. And that composition of the content is quite dynamic. You've got fish on one side to balance the, it's asymmetrical balance, they call it, between the signage on the left and the fish on the right. But the fish are in proportion. They also have specific colours, and there's contrasts, and there's balance. And there's all these elements and principles of visual art that have gone in, as well as the signage, which is indisputable information. Now, could those, the wording, Disney, and the name of Nemo, accidentally find itself on that bit of paper? It possibly could, but it would be meaningless unless there was a company called Disney and there was a movie that was made called Nemo. And so you've got this incredible empirical evidence right before our eyes that that poster proves the existence of at least one visual art designer. Now, it could be artificial intelligence, you might argue, but at least it proves intelligent design. So then my follow-up question. The actual clownfish, in its complex marine environment, in that symbiotic relationship with the anemone and everything else, with its eyes, its gills for breathing, its different sense organs, its immunobiological processes of mucus forming to keep the anemone toxins away, could all of that got there by chance? This fish has reproductive structures, it has skeletal structures, it has ophthalmology complexities to see accurately underwater. We can't see accurately underwater because light travels differently underwater. It's incredible when we think, could that anemone, clownfish rather, get there by chance? Now, the battle of ideologies out there in the world is that evolution claims, yes, it can. And yet they'll tell you, black and blue, that the poster could not get there. Which is the more complicated? Which is the more sophisticated? The poster or the real Nemo fish? That's where I'm arguing from. We are in this ideological warfare, and we've got to have courage to engage with it, with wisdom. Right, let's launch. Okay. And it's all based on this premise in Romans chapter 1, that the invisible things of God from the creation of the world are clearly seen by the things that are made, even his eternal power and divine attributes or divinity or deity, Godhead, so that people are without excuse. But the enemy has blinded them, and it's one of our challenges to try and help them to see. All right, so if we look at our Bibles in verse 20, it says, "And God said, let the waters bring forth abundantly the moving creature that has, interestingly, life." And this is the Hebrew chaynephesh, which means active, living, or breathing creature. That's the focus. We're not going to look at the birds. That will come in a subsequent session, two sessions' time. Let's just consider the marine creatures today. 71% of the Earth's surface is water. And on day five, God fills the waters of the Earth with moving creatures, marine life. You ready? You got your snorkel and goggle on? Got your wetsuit on, your flippers? Hope you got maybe a little breathing tanks, because here we go. Let's jump into the water and just start looking at what's under the surface. In verse 21, it says, "And God created great whales." And the Hebrew word here is tanim, which is variously translated in the Old Testament scriptures. It is sometimes translated whales, but other times it is translated dragon, serpent, or sea monster. It refers to a very large sea marine creature. Sometimes it's a whale, and sometimes it'll be referring to something else. And it says in verse 21, God not only created the whales and every living creature that moves, which the waters brought forth abundantly. Key little phrase, after their kind. Whales do not grow legs and come out on land, and they certainly didn't come from little wolf-like creatures and go into the water and become whales. Whales stay whales. Yes, you can get interbreeding of whales. Fish can interbreed, but fish stay fish, as 1 Corinthians says. There is a flesh of man, there's a flesh of birds, and there's a flesh of fish. There is. God has made different creatures after their own kind. Very important little bit of information there. You can get adaptation. God has built that in. If you, husband and a wife, marry, their genes combine together. They don't make a clone copy of either the husband or the wife. It's something new. And that's the way God's designed the genetic reproductive system. But we're not talking about macroevolution. We're not talking about fish becoming something totally different. Living things stay within their God-created kind. In this case, does anyone know what sort of a whale this is? It could be a humpback. It might be perhaps a right whale. There could be variations of that. But what's also special about its classification? What type of a whale is it?
This.
Yes, so it has this special baleen in its mouth which it uses to filter all the plankton and stuff. It's not what they call a toothed whale, like killer whales and sperm whales. Okay? It's a mammal. It breathes air in lungs like you and I do, and so it has to come up to the surface, whoosh, push out all the old air, and then slurp up a whole lot of new air in order to go down to the depths. Well, let's go a little further into the depths. I wonder what else is lurking below the surface of the oceans. Here we go. We're going to dive down now into the depths. It's amazing. When God said he made all these creatures that move, when you look at and study the movement of sea creatures, they are aquadynamic. Technologists and scientists and engineers are trying to copy the superior aquadynamic properties of the fins, the scales, the various design features of marine creatures so that things can move more easily through the water, like submarines and so on. Okay, hope you got a good breath of air. And off we go. So this is the zone where Brian's company gets a lot of its income from the pelagic fish. The fish of the sea comes from the Greek word pelagios, which means the sea or out in the ocean. And the zones of the ocean are divided into the sunlight zone, which goes to about that depth, and then there's the twilight zone, and then there's the complete dark zone, where there's really strange creatures like anglerfish with these little things with little lights in front of their mouths, and little creatures get drawn to the light, and all of a sudden, chomp, the thing gets devoured. But let's look at the immense, rich variety of living creatures migratory turtles. I'm going to, in a subsequent session, talk about the loggerhead turtle. Travels thousands of kilometres back to the same beach where it laid its eggs from the previous time, using a GPS system that is superlative to anything we've created. We've got things like your tuna, these sort of fish, which I'm sure Sanford loves to catch, anything, you know, like terakihis and karwais and what else do they love to catch? Orange ruffies and... what are some of the biggies, Brian?
And mackerel.
Yep, yeah, mackerel.
Really good protein.
Yep. Yes. And in amongst it all, we've got the different little crustaceans, little types of zooplankton and phytoplankton, which provides food for them all. You've got your jellyfishes and other types of marine creatures like this lionfish and so on. But just look at the way they move. They swim their way through the water. They've got different reflective zones on their bodies so that from the top, it's really hard for a predator to spot them down below. And if you're looking up, the lower part of the body looks dark, you know. And so it's quite amazing as they swim through the water. They're just beautifully designed. Wouldn't you wish that you could go out fishing, Fraser, and just put your line down and wham, they were all there, ready to go. There's incredible diversity. We've got fish, jellyfish, starfish, shellfish, cuttlefish, you name it sort of fish. It's incredible what's out there in the ocean. And I'd like us just to pause and think of this psalm. It's in Psalm 107, is it? I think it is. And verse 23-24. Would somebody like to read Psalm 107:23-24 for us?
And his wonders in the deep.
Yeah, thank you, Sarah. It's an amazing thing when you go kayaking or you go snorkeling or scuba diving or even, you know, just fishing off the rocks and you pull something up or you're looking at the rock pools and you find these living creatures. It is exciting. It's amazing. Even from, you know, when kids are very little, they find it fascinating. I've snorkeled around an amazing off an island called Tingloy off the western coast of the Philippines once. And the waters were beautifully tropically warm, and I could have stayed there for hours and hours and hours just with a basic mask and a snorkel. But what I saw was honestly something like out of the Disney movies, with all its vibrant colours and the different fish, tropical fish, absolutely stunning. I was just gobsmacked with the not only the vibrance, the brilliance of it all, but just the diversity and complexity. I've been out with a chap who used to come here, Athol, to Motiti Island in his boat. We used to go out, he would go out with a friend and he would go down scuba diving for the scallops. And I'd look after the boat and, you know, when he brings up the scallops, it's fascinating to see them. But once I was looking after the boat and there were these small whales moving in the distance out in the harbour. And, you know, you just, it's incredible. And then you pull in the long line and you see these amazing snappers and trevallies and things. And each time it never ceases to amaze me just how incredible they are with all the shiny colours on them and so on. So those that go down to the deep, that are sea in ships that do business in great waters, these see, there's empirical evidence, the works of Yahweh or Yahuwah. And his wonders in the deep. This is what we're talking about. The invisible things of him are clearly seen by the things that are made. What can we glean about the character, the person, the majesty, the creatorial power of our Creator God when we look at these marine creatures? That's the big question I want us to be reflecting on. All right, let's now go from the whales and the ocean and these schools of beautiful fish. Let's go to Nemo's land and look at one specific type of reef fish and look at its wonderful characteristics. Now, there's evidently over 30,000 different fish species. Over 30,000. They live in things like freshwater environments, like lakes and rivers, in estuaries where you get rivers coming out into the ocean, and it's a bit of a mixture of freshwater and saltwater. We've got coastal regions or habitats, and then there's reef habitats. Included in that diversity are the ocean and migratory or pelagic fish, and even some really freaky looking deep sea creatures. But we're just going to look at this one, and it's called the copperband butterfly fish because it's got these five bands, three, four, but where's the fifth? I'll show you that shortly. But I want you to look at the amazing features of these bands. The first band actually includes the eye. Isn't that extraordinary? What genetic coding would be needed to transfer the colour band that covers the scales of the skin? That in itself is pretty challenging. But to get it to imitate it across the actual surface of the eye is amazing. And then it's got a false sort of a eye at the back, which is not actually on its body, but it's actually on this fin. It's an amazing little creature. Here's the fifth stripe down its snout. Amazing, eh? Can't see it in that one, but I managed to get this shot and fit it so that we could have a look at its stripe on its snout. Now, how on earth you can randomly achieve the genetic coding for this sort of stunning design is mind-boggling. What I believe it illustrates for us is this idea of irreducible complexity of marine creatures. The fish either has to have the respiratory system that can extract oxygen and do all the gas exchanges that are needed in the water, or it is going to die. It has to have the reproductive systems all go, ready to reproduce its kind, or it'll go extinct. It is amazingly complex. Just the ophthalmology involved in the design of fish eyes with their spherical lenses is enough to blow anybody away. The lens has to be able to be suspended in the optic fluid at the back of the eye, not like ours, that our lenses are attached to the front of our eyes. The fish is moving all the time, and it has to have these amazing ligaments that can hold the spherical lens in place when it's wiggling its tail and moving around. And they've recently done some incredible studies on the eye lens of fish, and it's incredibly complex and sophisticated. Well, I think it's time we got into some something a bit more tactile, and there's nothing like the real fish. Is it Lily Rose? No. Is that how I got to think? Sarah Lily, sorry. Sarah Lily. Nothing like having something actually tangible that you can get your hands on. And I just happened to find a fish. Well, part of a fish on the way. Annette suggested it would smell, and I said, yep, that's what we want. So it's all part of appreciation. Oh, maybe the cat got its body, but well, something got munched. But I want you just to, hopefully I won't drop smelly stuff on the floor, but just look at this, freshly caught from the fish mark down in town. The eyes, the gill plates with, oh, they've been slightly munched, but we've got the gill cover where the gills would sit, and all the all the different organs, there is some of the gills there, and the look at the fins on the side, and it's camouflage, you know, because it lives amongst the seaweed and the rocks and things like this, so it doesn't get easily seen. And all the scales and the amazing things. And then, of course, if we can just open it up. Oh, I've still got some. Someone's hooking it. Ow. There. Juicy mouth. Whoa. Look at its teeth. Decent teeth. See? Look at this.
Yeah.
And can you see the nostrils? Do you know that inside those nostrils, there are amazing flaps that allow the water to go in and out. But there are these sense organs that have something like 50,000 little microstructures per square millimeter. They're so minute, little microstructures, and it allows the fish to sense, smell the different chemicals in the water to know whether it's juicy food or just something, you know, yucky. Look at that.
Yes.
Leela. It's incredible. And what you've got is structure and form and complexity that has to all be in place for this creature to actually live in its marine habitat. You can't have bits of it just developing by chance. So it's quite stunning. And then I thought, well, I couldn't not get this bit. And this bit is the structure of its skeleton. I don't know if you can see it better up against the light. Much better. And you've got the central bone, like a backbone in the middle, and all the little bones coming above and below. But look at its incredible flexibility as it wiggles its tail. And you've got this amazing fin up the top that can be lifted up to help steer it and guide it through the water. Isn't that an amazing design structure? And you can actually see the veins and the arteries weaving their way through. And at the back, you've got a decent-sized tail because that's where it gets its thrust from. You know, it has to have a decent tail to get its energy and movement. I find this absolutely fascinating evidence of design. It looks like it's perfectly made for what it needs to do. So, I knew I forgot something. It was that little hand towel with a bit of water on it. But I'm being brutally honest here. I actually now want to pass it around so that you can actually... I'll just pass the head. And there's nothing like getting up close to the face of the fish. Right. Thanks very much. So, let's now dig into some of the design features that are inherent in the marine creature that we call a fish. I hope I don't smell too bad. Okay, first of all, let's look at scales. Now, these scales, this is from a secular evolutionary article. They say scales provide optical disguise, number one. Optical disguise. So the different colours, patterns, they can help protect the fish and disguise it against its background. Next, we've got, they reduce water drag or the resistance as it moves through the water. They've got these beautiful surface properties that actually reduce drag and allow the fish to zoom through the water. And thirdly, it provides mechanical protection for the fish because the scales are quite tough. If they bang into something or if something tries to have a bit of a bite or even microorganisms trying to get in actually can't get in beneath the scales. So there's a threefold recognized description of the function of these things called scales. We probably thought they were just annoying when you're trying to fillet your fish. Well, that's what they look like closer up on one particular type of fish. They don't look like they're randomly made. They look like they're incredibly designed. So what's happening in the realm of biomimicry with fish scales? Well, they are now studying the unique structures, the placement and characteristics of scales to do this. This is a quote. The unique structures and stacking sequences of fish scales inspired the fabrication of artificial nanostructures with salient, and that word salient means noteworthy or important, optical, interfacial, which means common boundary between surface materials, and mechanical properties. Now, these are not new entrants studying the properties of fish scales. These are more than likely postgrad doctoral qualified biologists, engineers and so on, technologists. They're highly intelligent and they're using the characteristics of the fish scales to develop nanostructures that they can use in the world in which we live today. Surely that flies in the face of the concept that everything got here by chance without any intelligence. These are some of the applications that they've come up with so far. Optical coatings, sensing or lens arrays for use in reflective displays and solar energy harvesting, self-cleaning surfaces including anti-smudge, anti-fouling and anti-fogging, and self-sterilizing surfaces. These scales are amazing for fish. They're antibacterial properties, they resist the infections, they keep the fish clean and all the rest of it as they zoom through the water. I find it fascinating. Now, this is even more interesting. There's an Institute of Technology in Israel. Down here, the Israel Institute of Technology, they're currently working on developing body armor based on marine scales because they're strong but they're flexible, you see. As the fish is able to move easily with its scaled armor, they're developing now this material for soldiers to use that will have similar protective properties but not restrict their movement. Fascinating. Well, what about fish gills? Those amazing things that are inside the head. How do they work? What's so fascinating about fish breathing underwater? Well, in the diagram here, we've got water coming in through the mouth of the fish, and it goes through these gill plates and out again. Well, you might say that's pretty basic, yes. But in the process of the water going past the gill plates, amazing technology takes place. What takes place? Well, there's a gas exchange. If we look at it from an evolutionary perspective, you have to believe that the gills somehow know what oxygen molecules look like. And secondly, how on earth, at this atomic level, molecular level, they know how to, as the water's passing through, grab one. So you imagine all of us being seawater. And let's pretend that Ron is the oxygen molecule. And all of us are being squeezed past the gill plates. Now, the gill plates don't want to suck in. No offense, Pete, but you're seawater. And Sarah and Annabelle and Annette, no offense at all, but you're all seawater, you see. The gills only want Ron, the oxygen molecule. Now, how do those gills know to extract Ron and leave Leela and Ian and Fraser and all the rest of us to go through? Now, if that wasn't hard enough, as it's going through, there's an exchange of carbon dioxide and ammonia that's being discharged from the circulatory system of the fish. So it's grabbing oxygen here, getting rid of carbon dioxide and ammonia here, and it even gets more complicated. The process of the gills help to regulate the fish's immune system. It helps to regulate the ions and the metabolic needs of the fish and maintain its balance and pressure in its body as it swims through the water. Now, those gills are multifunctional, highly complex nanostructures, microstructures. How on earth could that develop by chance, even if you give it a billion years? You've either got them working, functioning well, or the fish dies. So let's go a little bit into this. This is from Monash University in Australia. And this is a quote from an article called Fish Gills Inspire Engineering Research. The research scholar is called Prasoon Kumar, a research scholar with Monash Research Academy, is working on a biomimicry-inspired project using, and I've put in brackets, so-called, this is a quote, highly evolved organization of fish gills. Now, these people don't share the insight, the understanding that you and I have, that God has created everything. But they come from this premise, and it's written into their journal articles, that they're engaging with these highly sophisticated gill structures, but they use the word evolved, which isn't proven. It's a scientific, philosophical view. It's not a scientifically proven view. And it comes through in all of the literature, and it pulls the wool over people's eyes. This article could have said using the highly organized fish gills. The word evolved is not science. That's imposed on it. It's a religious-like belief. And anyway, what I do find special is that they acknowledge that these gills are incredible. And what are they doing with them? Well, they're going to develop advanced gas-solute exchange systems. Now, a solute is like a liquid where it's got different chemicals dissolved in the water, but they want to get these things out and leave the rest behind, which is what the fish gills do. So they're studying these fish gills to apply them for wastewater management systems and such like today. Isn't that amazing? Highly organized fish gills? That's an understatement. These gills are stunning things. I've mentioned here in what I shared before, they're incredibly efficient. They filter the oxygen molecules from the water, and they know how to then absorb it into the bloodstream through the arteries and veins. They know how to get rid of CO2, carbon dioxide, and ammonium, and they help to equalize body pressure, maintain the immune defense, iron regulation, acid-base balance, and modify metabolic needs or metabolites. These gills are amazing. We just gloss over it. This guy evidently says, quote, "We are trying to mimic the hierarchical features of the fish gill structure to engineer advanced membranes for fluidic applications." Whew. You need brains to even understand what that is talking about, let alone mimic it. In other words, they're copying the superlative design and functional features of fish gills. Isn't that amazing? Well, what do they look like? And I scoured the internet and finally came up with a goby fish gill plate. This is a closer in photography called microscopy. And this is the goby fish little gill plates, and they look beautifully symmetrical and artistically designed little filaments that make up the gill plates. Incredible. And for those of you who are really interested in fluid mechanics and structures to get chemicals out of liquids, it's incredibly complicated. But this is a diagram of the lamellae of the gill plate of the fish. Water comes across the lamellae, and you've got all these arteries and veins, and somehow oxygen, like Ron, is nabbed, and the rest of it goes through, and then the oxygen, the rods, go into the arteries and through the fish. Incredible, eh? That cries out intelligent design. Just trying to draw that diagram is hard enough. Now, it'd be hard enough to get one shell together, but what an amazing thing that it can create. It can grow two shells. It's a bivalve mollusk. And it has to have this incredible hinge device that allows it to actually open and close in order to filter feed the water and to breathe and to do its thing. I find the glue, the sort of ligaments that are needed to hold these shell halves together, absolutely stunning as well. Have a look at those, Leela. Now, what's fascinating about some of the shells is that they have these spiral patterns on them. And these spiral patterns actually closely sometimes follow an amazing mathematical numeric sequence called the Fibonacci sequence. Now, in addition, the Bible doesn't say anything about shells, But it does talk about an object of great price that is obtained from a shellfish, namely the pearl. And there's some interesting things in the scriptures about pearls, and here's a little pearl for you to think about. In Matthew's Gospel, chapter 13, Jesus says that the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant who goes about his business and comes across this pearl of great price, a very special, naturally, you know, organically grown one, not one of these synthetic ones. And by the way, the number of fake pearls out in the market is evidently quite phenomenal. And there are ways of telling fake pearls, but that's a side issue. But the real pearls are incredible concretions of this nacre material that the shellfish, the oysters, secrete around a bit of grit. And they have incredible light properties, and they're very beautiful to behold, and they've always been treasured by people through the ages. Now, this merchant, when he finds a pearl of great price, he sells everything he has to buy that one special pearl. And it got me thinking, how much do I truly value the kingdom of heaven, the kingdom of God? How much do I truly value what God has revealed to me? Am I willing to do like that merchant in this little story that Jesus gave and sell everything and to really get focused on that which pertains to God and his kingdom? It's a powerfully challenging thought. But if we look at these shells and their mathematical patterns, I just want you to consider this for a moment. Now, when we look at these patterns, some of them, you know, look quite spirally, like, you know, like this. And you think, is that just a random sort of design? Is it, or what is it? How do you get that sort of a pattern? And there's a series of numbers where you take two numbers and then you add them together to get the next number. And the previous two get added together. And the previous two get added together. This one would be 8. And this would be 13. And so on. Now, what happens is if you take those numbers and you square them, so you get 1 by 1 square. And if you take an arc from one corner to the other corner, it would look like that, right? The next number in the sequence is 2. And if we have a square that is 2 squared and then do the arc from corner to corner, it would be like that. The next in the sequence is 3 squared. And if we drew it out here, it would look like this. And the arc would go here. The next number in the sequence is 5. And if we did 5 squared, it would look like this. And the arc would go from here. The next is 8 squared, which is like this, and the arc would go here. And lastly, for the sake of time, this would be about 13 squared, and the arc would look like this. Now, this pattern follows very closely to this Fibonacci series of numbers. It's a mathematical sequence, and it's built into so many of the shells that we enjoy. So I'm just going to grab a few and show you. So here's one for you to pass around. There's one. Ta-dum. Ta-dum. Here's one, Leela, for you.
Thank you.
Here's another cool one. Here's a big juicy one. I think he was an Italian mathematician.
And what he discovered was the ancient Greek scientist that all the men used on a lot of the architecture. and the Italians basically had a renaissance, which is called Berlin, which is still up in involving the American government building, but based on that kind of architecture, the urban
architecture. That's funny. Here we are.
Well, the shelf that Alistair is passing right now is actually not Fibonacci.
No, they're not quite.
The Nautilus is possibly the best example
of
pure Fibonacci.
Yep.
Although this one's close.
Yep. And then the power is also very close to the Fibonacci. Here we are. Now, if we think about these shells for a moment, here's the Fibonacci series of numbers and the pattern that is formed, like I drew on the whiteboard. And I'm just going to superimpose some photos of some shells and then bring this to a close. So here's one. It's close to, but it's not quite the Fibonacci series, but it is nonetheless mathematically determined. It is an incredible outward growing spiral in its shell structure. Here's another one, the good old power, and I'm passing three of the powers around. Keep them moving, because the power does actually follow, I think, quite closely the Fibonacci sequence. But here's one that I think definitely meets what Chris was saying, and it's this one. Now, Kevin has to be very quiet on this one, because he actually knows what it is. Pass this little guy around. This does follow the Fibonacci sequence. Here we are. Here we are. All right. Now, the question is, does anyone know what shell this comes from?
The tube worm.
Tube worm. Thanks, Ellen. Any other suggestions? I'm just trying to see if there's any other possibilities. Sarah Lilly, what do you think this comes from? Any? A what? Yeah. Well, it actually comes from Kevin.
I suggest it's a pygmy nautilus.
And it's actually called, believe it or not, it's called a ram's horn squid. And this ram's horn squid is only about this long, 4 to 5 centimetres, and it looks like this. And there's the shell in the back of it. And I found those examples just to the south of Main Beach down at Mount Maunganui. In fact, most of these shells have all come from the Mount area or Papamoa Beach.
Is that related to an ammonite at all? Yeah.
The nautilus is a type of squid-type creature. You know, it hides in the shell, and those ammonites were huge. I mean, they are massive. But the point is that what we find in these created marine creatures is mathematics. Mathematics. Now, where does mathematics come from? You know, mathematical properties, formula. It has to come from intelligence. Mathematical sequences do not just form randomly by chance. That's the point I'm trying to finish up with. So, it's very exciting when we consider what God has made in the way of these marine creatures. And I hope that as a starter, you found that useful, and we'll build upon this in subsequent sessions. There's a little thought-provoking conundrum, though, in this photo as we wrap it up. Something is wrong with day 5 of creation. What do you think's not quite right with day 5 of creation? And we can talk about this over a cup of tea. What's a mismatch in this photo with the idea of what it says. And God blessed them, saying, be fruitful, be and multiply, fill the waters of the sea. And the evening and the morning were the fifth day.
Are we assuming that they're carnivores at that stage?
Exactly. Thank you very much.
And is that assumption correct?
This photo has a problem with it in that it illustrates carnivory amongst marine creatures. And I leave that with you. Was carnivory part of God's original creation on day five? And how would you answer that to somebody who asked you? Thank you.